The Tom Woods Show, episode 2185.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, folks, if you've decided it's best not to have your kids educated by people who have declared war on you, then consider the self-taught Ron Paul curriculum. Instructors like me will give your kids an unfair advantage and an education you and I could only have dreamed of. But make sure you join through my link, because only there do you get my $160 worth of free bonuses. My link is ronpaulhomeschool.com. Hey, everybody. Tom Woods here. Jeff Deist of the Mises Institute is with us today. Jeff is the president of the Mises Institute. He was also Ron Paul's last chief of staff before Dr. Paul retired from Congress. And I want to talk about a column Jeff wrote recently. I think it's called We Don't Believe You. And it had in part to do with the FBI raid on Mar-a-Lago, that you have to look at this in context. You don't just look at this as one isolated episode. You have to look at it in the context of the regime's approach to Donald Trump and its attacks on him, his family. It's impossible to look at this and say, well, Merrick Garland is just trying to uphold the rule of law. That is not absolutely not what's going on, especially when you see how selectively applied it is. So I want to talk about that. And no doubt we will wind up on the topic of national divorce, about which I am happy to say I have, yes, that's right, a brand new free ebook coming out in just a matter of days called National Divorce, The Peaceful Solution to Irreconcilable Differences. Anyway, I'll keep you posted on that. Jeff, welcome back.
Good morning, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Very glad to be talking to you. So, and by the way, that's very sporting of you, given that the time zone I'm in, it's in the morning. You're giving the impression that I wake up responsibly, but it's afternoon for the rest of the country. I'm out here in Los Angeles for a few days. In fact, I just wrote an email about this. This isn't what we were going to talk about, but we have a fairly, you know, I would say nice hotel, but in downtown LA. And I just had somebody, sort of prominent entertainment figure, say to me, why do you visit Los Angeles and stay in downtown LA? So we went out and we took a walk last night, and it's just lost souls and wreckage everywhere you turn around here. You know, I understand the advantages of living in California or Los Angeles, but the many tragedies you walk by everywhere you turn, it just gets to be overwhelming.
That really is something, the homeless issue.
Yeah. So anyway, but you know, the reason I think state and city governments can get away with what they get away with is that it is so attractive to be here. There are so many non-political reasons you want to be here that they know they can exploit you, because, you know, where are you going to go? You know, Albuquerque? You know, and yet you'd probably have fewer problems. I don't know. Anyway, let's get to what I wanted to talk to you about, which is pretty open-ended, but you had a piece on the subject, We Don't Believe You, as being the way we should respond to the claims of the regime. And in particular, the whole matter of the FBI and Donald Trump has been on everybody's minds. And you've had some people saying, the usual voices saying that, of course, it's unthinkable to accuse the FBI of any kind of inappropriate behavior. Why, they're just there to enforce the law, and we have to live under laws, and even the president is subject to the law. And they all say this with a straight face, but we all know the deeper meaning of what's going on here.
Yeah, the idea that presidents are subject to the law is absolutely laughable by anyone with even a cursory understanding of U.S. history. So we ought to start with that. But the reaction to this has been interesting to me because, of course, from the administration's position, Merrick Garland, I mean, he's basically a scorned Supreme Court justice, someone who felt he was unfairly excluded from the highest court in the land during the final days of the Obama administration. And so he's had it in for Donald Trump as Joe Biden's AG, of course. And the idea that he would investigate a former president, which virtually never happens, and all of them have left office with many, many documents. This is not, you know, unique. What is unique here is the selective prosecution potentially being considered. But the idea that he would investigate Trump, that he would get a search warrant executed by a magistrate, not a federal judge, a magistrate who apparently is a pretty anti-Trump guy, take that for what it's worth, have it executed in the early hours in a raid-like fashion and do all this, you know, investigating not only a former president, not only the person against whom his boss ran last time, but in fact, the most likely person against whom his boss might run in 2024. So it's clearly a political opponent. It was clearly intended to serve as a warning to Trump and to Trumpers, to his family. It was clearly intended to make them think about their own financial fortunes, the Trump empire, such as it is, whether they could continue to have the money and lifestyle to which they're all accustomed if, in fact, their dad or grandfather or a father-in-law or whomever is dragged into jail, which is possible. So, you know, the idea that this won't look political or shouldn't be considered political is so laughable. But okay, the idea that we're all jaded about politics and divided is nothing new. But here's what is new, Tom. I was driving from Atlanta Airport recently, flipping through the dial, and I come across Dennis Prager. Of course, many of you are familiar with Prager U and his whole empire out in California. And I've actually seen him one time at the Atlanta Airport. So I'm waiting for a flight. And so he was talking about conservatives and the FBI, the CIA, the NSA, the spying and intelligence apparatus. And this is an older guy. He's definitely a baby boomer. It's harder at that stage of your life to change, presumably, and also a longtime conservative guy, probably a neoconservative if you had to describe him. And he basically said on the radio, he said, you know, I was wrong. I was wrong about the FBI and the CIA and the NSA and even the military, all these institutions and organizations that I thought stood for law and order, that I thought conservatives should support unequivocally. I was just wrong about them. They're actually corrupted, they're captured, and they're used by our enemies in the bureaucratic state. I don't like the term deep state because that implies something other than what it is. In the bureaucratic state are out to get us and harm us politically, economically, and otherwise. So I thought that was pretty profound. That represents a shift for a guy like that. I mean, I suppose we could call him a normie-con in many ways. For a guy like that to say something like that at this stage of his life, I think shows that he thinks things are pretty far gone. And so what we understand today as the divisive rhetoric or the fact that a lot of conservatives are not so pro-military anymore, not so pro-FBI anymore, not so pro-police anymore, you know, all these things have antecedents. We have to understand, you can't understand Woodrow Wilson without understanding the earlier progressive era. You can't understand the earlier progressive era without understanding some of the changes from the Civil War, you know, that sort of thing. You can't understand Reagan in certain senses without understanding Barry Goldwater. You can't understand Reagan in certain senses without understanding the 60s and 70s and the reaction to that. And then you can't understand perhaps Pat Buchanan without understanding Ronald Reagan and Barry Goldwater. So we always have antecedents. And I think Pat Buchanan and even Ross Perot in many ways presaged Ron Paul. And I think in many ways, Ron Paul presaged Donald Trump in that there was this revolution brewing, that there was this quiet populism, which has become less quiet of late, and that there really is something afoot. And that a lot of average people sense, maybe they can't completely pin or identify it. They don't want to live political lives. They want to be normal people and worry about their kids and their mortgages and such. But that average normal people are really starting to sense that something's deeply, deeply wrong with the federal government. And so I thought, wow, when Dennis Prager said that, you know, that's really a sign that even someone, I assume he has a reasonable amount of money in his life and reasonable status and a longtime conservative worldview. And he's old enough to come from that old age of the George Herbert Walker Bushes and that sort of thing. And I thought, wow, that's really something, because you can be in the middle of a revolution and not even really know it.
To me, this is among the most interesting political developments out there. I mean, first, we had at least some growing skepticism about military adventurism, which is something, because we struggled with that for years and years. And now you start to see some people, now they're the ones who are on the outs, but some people within the GOP who, you know, sometimes they sound like Rothbard when they talk about this stuff. That's a good thing. But for them even to graduate to the point of saying that these institutions that I'm sure they thought were, you know, as American as apple pie are in fact weaponized against us and they're political and we need to do something about them, that's a huge, huge thing. And then meanwhile, I know I give more attention to these people than they deserve. Meanwhile, we have like the left libertarians who think the real issue is that these people are fascists. What? What is the matter with you at a moment when you have some of the American right wing waking up and realizing that they've enabled the very institutions that are threading the noose around their necks, you'd think that would be a moment to celebrate. Oh, good, these people are coming around. But if you hate these people's guts to start with, and that's your starting premise, then you can never welcome anything good from them.
Well, Libertarian Inc. hates and has contempt for rural, red Trump America, white working class. I mean, this is evident, and they've really behaved poorly. Right?
They would take Dick Cheney a million times over before they would take an Anthony Sabatini or any of these up-and-coming people.
Well, and these aren't people who just preferred Gary Johnson to Ron Paul or preferred Hillary Clinton to Donald Trump. These are people who prefer Hillary Clinton to Ron Paul.
Yeah.
Okay, that's what we need to understand, first and foremost. And second of all, because they hate deplorables so much, they can't even grudgingly give credit when a bunch of people over the last 5 years on the right have really come around on foreign policy compared to the W. Bush years, have really come around on foreign policy, have really come around on military adventurism, and have really come around on bureaucratic overreach. So today, we're in a situation, Tom, where the rank and file right is actually far better than its political class, you know, Republicans, the GOP, Mitch McConnell's of the world.
Yeah.
And they're much, much better. You know, and I guess that's somewhat true of the rank and file left, too. The rank and file left is probably more, a little more amenable to the Tulsis of the world, whereas the Nancy Pelosi's of the world are just, you know, so far gone. But nonetheless, for libertarians, out of sheer animosity and this fetish for insisting that they're neither left nor right, forget Republican or Democrat, conservative or liberal, left or right, that's a holistic thing. That's about hierarchy and tradition and family and culture and all kinds of things. So most people, despite all their highfalutin rhetoric, have an impulsive, reflexive left or right, somewhat worldview, okay? So for them to deny the growth, the positive direction of people on the right talking about the deep state and talking about foreign policy and talking about elites, in other words, stealing the thunder of the populism that the left thought it had with Occupy Wall Street and all that, these are all healthy things. And obviously, I'm worried about America, and I hope we don't have to go through any sort of violent schism. But if the alternative to that is simply lying here and taking it, then yeah, we ought to be cheering this populism.
Let me just say a quick word. I would guess about 10, probably a little bit over 10 years ago, I made my one appearance on Dennis Prager's show. And it was two spots separated by a commercial break. In the first one, we talked domestic policy, and he just thought, I was just singing right out of his hymn book. He just thought I was the best guy ever. Then we came back from the break, and he wanted to talk foreign policy. And I thought, you know, I could sugarcoat this for this guy, you know, because we've just become friends, and he liked what I had to say. But what's the point? You know, I'm on with his big audience. I need people to hear that somebody who just said these things about domestic policy might say something like this about foreign policy. They need to hear that. So I just gave them, you know, pure Ron Paulianism. And of course, he was shocked and appalled and everything. So it really is a change when he looks at these institutions and says, huh, I really need to rethink this. Yeah, I was in the midst of it in my appearance on his show. I remember it distinctly. Now, related to all this is this idea that Americans have been trained to think, which is that somehow law enforcement and specifically the courts are above politics, they're above all these petty things. The decisions made in the law enforcement and then in the courts and the legal community are made atop a platonic mountain, you know, where no base considerations enter. But when you think about the ordinary people you encounter every day, and think of how petty so many of them are, how covetous they are, how envious they are, nasty they are, tribalistic they are, what would make you think that the unbelievably ambitious legal class would be any better than the regular run of humanity?
Yeah, or your local DA, frankly. That's just the way the world is. I mean, people are imperfect, and so we rely on institutions and processes, the rule of law, to protect us from the avarice or cruelty of particular individuals within those systems. And so people, I think, have just given up on this idea that the rule of law is protecting us, that due process is happening, that courts are generally creating impartial outcomes, that police are generally acting impartially, and that politicians are generally acting for the public's overall well-being, even though they have their political spats. I just think the average person has abandoned that kindergarten after-school special view of the world. And I don't think that was true of adults when I was a kid. I think when I was a kid, 30, 40 years ago, a lot more adults really believed in all of that, even though they might complain about politics or, oh, those damn Democrats, those damn Republicans. But I think something pretty fundamental has shifted. And on the one hand, we have to cheer it because we need to not be like children when it comes to our examination of history and power in the United States. We need to be grown-ups. That's what it means to put away childish things, is to view the world with a clear eye. But the flip side is that it portends a really rough period ahead for America. And it's so sensible. I mean, you've pointed this out. I remember we had an event a few years back in Houston on secession, and Rand Paul at the time was running for Senate, and there was some snarky Washington Post reporter that they sent to try to dig up dirt on Rand, who wasn't at the event, had nothing to do with it, but basically hang him with the words of his father, Ron, you know, talking favorably about secession at a conference. Well, that doesn't seem so radical anymore, for one. And it just strikes me that what you said at that conference, if I recall it, I'm just paraphrasing, is that, like, look, this is so sensible. It's staring all of us right here in the face, is that we can have an amicable resolution of our differences, and that political systems exist to serve us, not the other way around. They're not written in stone any more than a marriage is written in stone, you know, however you want to view it. But it just seems so logical. And it's still today, though, you know, all the action on this seems to be on the right. I mean, there are some groups in California and stuff on the left, but for the most part, it's people on the right saying, hey, look, this isn't working anymore, and we don't want any part of it. So what does the left do? The left in response says, oh, no, you can't leave. You're being histrionic. How dare you? Just because you're losing, just because you can't win in a democratic process, you don't get to take your ball and go home. It's like, well, wait a minute. Who's being histrionic? Who wants to abolish the Electoral College? Because it's doing what it's supposed to do, by the way. Who wants to get rid of the U.S. Senate, or at least have the U.S. Senate be proportional to population? I mean, who's being histrionic? Who wants to jail people for, you know, milling around in the Capitol building on January 6th? I mean, I would argue that the histrionics are at least as strong on the left.
Meanwhile, Marjorie Taylor Greene, not too long ago, made favorable remarks about the consequences of a national divorce, that maybe this would solve our problems to some degree. At least we could maybe proceed more peacefully with each other. And of course, you know, you can imagine what was said. And we even, again, we have people supposedly in our camp who they would die 1,000 deaths before agreeing with her on anything. But since for most of them, and by most of them, I mean like blue-pilled libertarians, if we want to call them that, because the idea of a national divorce is not strictly allowed by, you know, I mean, Dick Cheney doesn't want you talking about it. Hillary Clinton doesn't want you talking about it. So it's really kind of gauche for us to be talking about it. And so it just makes Marjorie Taylor Greene all the more of a wacko extremist fascist. Whereas I think it makes her pretty bold and interesting, way more bold and interesting than the stuffed shirts these people want to nominate, or more bold and interesting than the Squad, whom there is actually a sliver of libertarians who say the Squad, AOC's group, is the most libertarian in Congress. Again, I'm devoting way too much time to this sliver of the movement. But I hear somebody, an elected official, a U.S. congressman, saying we need to think about national divorce. That is unambiguously a good thing. Unambiguously. And we shouldn't have to say, now, whatever you think about Marjorie Taylor, screw that. This was a bold thing to say, and good for her for saying it.
Though the irony here is that the left could have so much of what it wants here and now in those blue states, those deep blue states, if only they were willing to give up wanting to have everything they want everywhere in 50 years or 100 years, or I don't know, at this rate, it may only be 20. So they think they're winning. That's what you have to understand. In the left progressive mindset, they are the good people. They are the morally superior people. And that what they believe in and what they promote, although it's always changing, you know, every 5 years, what you thought a few years back becomes retrograde and racist and sexist and transphobic and all that. But nonetheless, they have an innate sense of inevitability to their progressive worldview. You know, this is happening. This is the future. It's unstoppable. Yes, it's unfortunate that we have these Neanderthal MAGAs in the way of progress and slowing it down, but, you know, we will overcome them. So no, red state, racist, neo-Confederates, we're not going to give you a single inch of territory in America. We are going to politically, let's hope it's only politically, vanquish you. I mean, that's what they're effectively saying. When you say that 40% of the country is irredeemable deplorables, but then you also say, and I'm against breaking up the political union with that 40%, then what you're effectively saying is that, and therefore I intend to vanquish them.
Yeah.
Right?
What else could it mean?
What else could it mean?
Hey, everybody, I want to take a minute to tell you about the number one expat event of the year. It is the Expat Money Summit, put together by our friend Mikkel Thorup. We just talked to him on the Tom Woods Show. That was an absolutely great conversation. This is a guy who knows what he's talking about. He's been an expat for over 20 years himself, having visited over 100 countries and resided in 9. Well, you can get info from Mikkel's personal circle of experts on everything you need to know about the expat life, migration, residencies, citizenship, investment, the expat lifestyle, and more. The event features names like Doug Casey, Vitya Litchka, the founder of Liberland, and the great Ron Paul as well. Whole bunch of speakers who can help guide you as you figure out your options in a crazy world. For a limited time, you can still access a free ticket to the event at expatmoneysummit.com. So make sure to check this thing out. From the comfort of your own home, you can learn what all these experts have to teach you. expatmoneysummit.com. Meanwhile, Andrew Yang wants to start a third party. You saw this news item?
You know, he should create a sleep aid.
Yeah, I know it. I actually said, because he wants to do this thing with Christine Todd Whitman, former boring Republican governor of New Jersey. So I think I said, for those of you who enjoy falling asleep, your ship has come in.
Is there a way we could get George Will on board on this? Is he still alive?
I think he is. I think I would have heard if he had died. Yeah, that's certainly possible. And then just the past few days, we've seen Yang on Twitter talking about what a brave person Liz Cheney is. So basically, Yang's outlook is, you know, America's not so bad the way it is. We just need a few electoral changes. But I mean, if you actually could be cheering Liz Cheney as opposed to seeing her as the most grotesque kind of exhibit A of what's wrong with America, then we live in different universes.
Well, I saw him grilled by that Acosta creep on CNN. Is he CNN? I think he is.
Yeah, he is.
And so Acosta asked him a pointed question about Dobbs, the recent abortion decision,
and he wiggled
and waggled his way around on that. But here's what he should have said. He should have said, you know what? We can't solve abortion politically. There are too many strongly held beliefs on both sides of it. And even on those two sides of it, within those parameters, you know, how late, how early, all kinds of things, whether it would be for Down syndrome kids or not, you know, there's a lot of permutations within the broader pro-life, pro-choice camps. But he should have just said, you know what? That's above my pay grade. We'll never solve this politically. And therefore, I agree with the thrust of the Dobbs decision, which is to decentralize this as much as possible and decide at the state level. It may even have to be more localized than that. Who knows? And so I believe that for the good of America and for the health of America, culturally, socially, you know, so that we can ratchet down these culture wars, that this is the way to go. And if blue states want to react to Dobbs by passing their own state laws, which are highly permissive, then that's what they should do. You know, I mean, it's not rocket science. I mean, this is what you would say. And there are people on our side who disagree with this too. I mean, Judge Knapp is a big pro-life advocate, very pro-life, very Catholic. And that, you know, in the circles he's run in throughout his career, that hasn't done him any favors. I mean, he's just done that out of principle, to his great credit. But nonetheless, he thinks the Dobbs court should have gone a step further. He believes in the 14th Amendment and corporation doctrine. I strongly disagree with that. But he believes the Dobbs court, under the auspices of the 14th Amendment, should have taken protection of life and liberty and gone ahead and included abortion under that rubric and said, therefore, Dobbs should have been decided to create a national prohibition on abortion effectively, or at least a national prohibition on abortion after a certain period when it becomes life under Judge Knapp's definition. So that would be the federalization of the pro-life position. And even Ron Paul, who was obviously very pro-life throughout his career, he didn't want to do that. He disagreed with that approach and thought that he would rather live in a system where certain states, presumably blue states, would have very permissive abortion laws, which might make Ron uneasy, but yet nonetheless, under the broader principles of federalism, was their due. So here we are, in that Andrew Yang, who probably is a smart guy. I mean, I think he went to an Ivy League. I don't know. Tom, did you go to an Ivy League school? Was that Rutgers that you went to? Wait, was that Fordham? Or was it Florida State you went to?
Will you leave me alone? At this point, I'm kind of ashamed to be associated with these institutions, which wouldn't have allowed me in the past couple of years because of the vaccine issue.
Oh, right. That was Villanova. I forgot.
Yeah.
So yes. Anyway, Andrew Yang is, I'm sure he's a smart guy. And I'm not saying he's not a smart guy, but in his lane,
he's probably smart, right? But not on everything.
That he couldn't enunciate a simple American principle of federalism as a new, as a, I hate to say it, in this day and age, a novel approach to ratcheting down this dreadful culture war is really pathetic.
Well, especially since he's supposed to be, because he trumpets himself as being different from your traditional options. So for him just to repeat one side's talking points, well, yeah, that is a little
bit. Well, if we're going to have Christine Todd Whitman, we definitely need Bill Weld. Oh, man.
Well, look, on this abortion thing, if you had done that, if you had gone beyond Dobbs and said, look, the language of the 14th Amendment means no abortions can be allowed anywhere in America, which I'm quite certain nobody drafting the 14th Amendment even gave that the remotest thought, then you would instantly get court packing. I mean, it would just be impossible to get around that. It would be politically overwhelming. I think you would get court packing and then you would get the status quo ante once again. I think that's what would happen. So I know there's a temptation to force social change through politically, but it's an elastic band and it's going to come back and smack you in the wrist. You should instead favor what you're favoring, which is try to work this out on a decentralized basis, the way you should try to work out all issues, all issues.
But that really is interesting that progressives right here, right now, we wouldn't even need a true secession where, you know, a new state or a new area is created with its own legislature. We could just have an aggressive degree of federalism along the lines of Dobbs applied to all kinds of issues, guns, you name it. But the fact that progressives aren't okay with that, I mean, we're offering them an opportunity to basically say, I don't have to wake up in the morning and worry about whom Alabama might elect because it barely matters. You know, we have a really broad degree of federalism and subsidiary in this country under the Constitution and the separation of powers and states' rights and all that. And so, you know, really all the federal government's doing is sticking to a few enumerated functions. I mean, the fact that they just would absolutely laugh that out of the room shows you either that they're unserious because they could have what they want, or maybe that they are serious and that they play the long game and they'd rather have everything 100 years from now or 50 years from now than have everything now, but just in a few deep blue states. So you got to hand it to folks on the left. I mean, they're not kidding. They will go and get jobs teaching high school. They'll get low-paid jobs in media. They'll do all kinds of things. Richard Hanania, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, has an interesting Substack on why progressives win, and they just care more. In other words, that there's a worldview or a mindset that says we need to be busybodies controlling and intruding into everything. And then there's a worldview and mindset that says, I kind of just want to worry about my own business or my own family or my kids' school or sports and paying my mortgage. And I don't really want to lead a political life. I just kind of want to be left alone. Well, I think what we found, and I've had to change my tune on this, Tom, it has not been easy for me here in, shall we say, middle age, midlife, to change. But I, you know, politics is interested in us. And so I've said this before, even 10 years ago, I was one of those people who really poo-pawed any sort of political activism and really said, you know, some disgruntled cop or DMV employee, the cop who pulls me over, the DMV employee who refuses my, you know, to update my sticker because I didn't cross the T on some form, you know, they have more power over me than Google or Twitter ever could because my relationship with Google and Twitter is voluntary. And my relationship with that cop is involved, you know, okay. All right. Well, I mean, here we are. You know, we have to see the world as it is. And, you know, we have, I think, a lot of momentum behind this idea of, if not a national divorce, than certainly an aggressive degree of federalism. But there's only one way in the short term to get it or to move closer to it, and that is progressive lefts have to suffer some losses. None of this is possible when they win. Okay, if Hillary Clinton had won in 2016, I mean, do you think we would even be entertaining an iota of this? I mean, it would have been like, no, the American public, you can fool people for a while, but ultimately the American public did the right thing and didn't vote for the crazy orange man with the reality TV show and voted for, Hillary Clinton, who was clearly, as part of the progressive sweep of history, meant to be the first female president. And Americans are quite sensible when you get down to, that would have been the news story.
Yeah, right.
And if that had happened, I mean, who would have thought Donald Trump, a guy who was from New York City, not at all animated by social issues, not a religious conservative in the slightest, that Donald Trump would be the guy who ended up putting three judges on the Supreme Court and we would overturn Roe? Man, oh man, you could have gotten, if there was ever a bet on that, on one of these betting sites, websites, you'd have gotten 10,000 to one. I mean, it's almost unreal to me that Roe v. Wade was overturned.
Yeah. Honestly, it makes no sense according to the way I look at the world. So I consider myself somewhat chastened by that I failed to see that coming. But I also consider myself to be an excellent company of other people who failed to see it coming. Before we wrap up, you at the Mises Institute have a couple of big events coming up, September, October. Is the September one sold out?
Well, we have a scholars conference in Nashville the first weekend in September. I don't know the date offhand, but it's that first Saturday in September. Now, our hotel block is sold out, but that might be a good thing because everything in Nashville suddenly became hellishly expensive. So you might be better off with Airbnbs or, finding a hotel a little farther out or something like that. But yeah, you're welcome to come. I'm going to actually be delivering a summation of my new paper on language and the evolution thereof versus what I would consider more of a top-down control of language. And we're going to have Daniel McCarthy is going to speak about the old fusionism movement back with Pat Buchanan and Murray Rothbard and Lou Rockwell in the early 90s and whether that's, has any resurgence today. So there's going to be some very interesting papers and topics. But then more importantly, we're going to have a real gala out in Phoenix, Arizona, our 40th anniversary celebration in October. And that's Thursday and Friday, basically the 6th and 7th. And so that's going to be sort of a nice weekend at a very fancy schmatzy resort.
That's October, by the way.
October, yes. That's October. Yeah. And we're going to have lots and lots of guests, just a who's who list of 20 or so great speakers. We're going to have a packed day. We're going to have some fun activities. And so that's, if you're a fan of the Mises Institute, you should check it out.
I will be one of the speakers myself. Just to clarify, the Nashville event is actually September 10th.
Right, that sounds right.
September 10th. So you can find Mises Institute events on the Mises website, mises.org/events, if you'd like to attend one of these. As I say, I will be at the Phoenix event. Very much looking forward to it. I remember, as if it were yesterday, the 35th, the 30th anniversary events. These are just some of the most amazing times. And I can't wait for it. So thanks, Jeff. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
All right, everybody. Remember, it's August 2022, so it's back to school time. And if you're thinking of using the self-taught Ron Paul curriculum, then of course you want to subscribe to it through my link because my link gives you a bunch of extra bonuses that you don't get if you just go through the main site. So you got to go through me to get some really, really great goodies that will make you super duper happy. My link is ronpaulhomeschool.com. So go check that out. I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.